5, 6, 7.
We Jews have a reputation for generosity. My favorite bit of evidence is a wonderful comment which one can find in the Talmudic literature. One of the sages was pondering the story of the golden calf. Remember, after the 3 months after the Israelites left Egypt, they were brought to Mount Sinai. And God there demands that Moses climb the mountain to receive the revelation, his instructions. And Moses is gone from the camp for 40 days and 40 nights. And this group of ex-slaves become anxious as the days pass. There's no visible presence of authority among them. And finally, they turn to Aaron and they say, "Make us a God who will go before us." And Aaron's response is to tell them to go back to their tents and to take the jewelry of their wives, the golden jewelry, and to bring this jewelry to him. And it's out of this gold which the molded image will emerge. And the sage, commenting on this not very glorious episode in our tradition, says, "What a wonderful people we are, generous among the generous. Jews will even give for the most unworthy of causes." Now, generosity, however much it may be part of our cultural tradition, is not a genetic inheritance. You're not born generous. You're trained to be generous. You're trained by your parents. You're trained by a religious school which asks you to bring in tzedakah, sunshine, every week. You're trained by the whole pattern of a community for whom the raising of money for various good purposes is taken to be one of the basic, unquestioned responsibilities of Jewish citizenship. We find then, interestingly, that already in the Bible, our leaders were not satisfied simply to encourage charity. Everybody knows that Hebrew has no word for charity, just the word tzedakah, which means justice. The underlying idea, of course, is that we don't really possess that which we think we possess. We are simply stewards of God's possessions. We've simply been fortunate enough to be given part of God's patrimony. And so we find that, unlike many other cultural and religious traditions, the Bible is not willing simply to encourage the spirit to be generous, the spirit to move when it sees a pauper, a beggar, a poor man. But the Bible makes any number of attempts to structure welfare, care for the poor, into the very organization of the community itself. The Bible commands what's called a ma'aser ani, a tithe for the poor. Once every 3 years, the ancient Israelite was to have all of his property assessed, and 1/10 of it was to be given over to the community for the use, for uses which we would call welfare uses: food, clothing, shelter for the indigent, for the pauper, for those who can't provide for themselves. Most know about the provision in the Bible that after the farmer had scythed his field, whatever grain was left standing could not be cut a second time, but was to be left for the poor. And the same, of course, was true for the vineyard and for the orchard. After it had once been gleaned and picked over, it could not be picked over again except by those whose right it was to come out and to take for nothing that which would provide for them. Less well known, but certainly structurally more important, were the sabbatical year laws. On the seventh year, all debts were to be remitted. A poor man was not to be endlessly burdened by his inability to repay what he had borrowed to try and get grain to plow his, to sow his field, to begin the, to have another harvest. And if his land had been taken from him in default of debt, or if he had to sell himself into slavery because of debt, on the sabbatical year, his land was to be returned to him and his debt was to be forgiven and his enslavement was to end. In every way possible, biblical man attempted to see that simple justice was done, to see to it that Israel was a welfare state, truly with the welfare of all at heart. Now, given this experience, given this tradition, I find it to be one of the most unfortunate elements in the policies of the present administration that an explanation of their claim that the cuts which they have instituted in various pieces of welfare legislation, their claim that these cuts will not harm the poor because the wealthy will take over and voluntary contributions will make up for the failure of the government to meet its responsibilities. It's simply not true that the poor, the indigent, the helpless can depend upon the rather haphazard promptings of the hearts of the wealthy. It has never been true in history. It will not be true now. In part, because these promptings are haphazard, because they are erratic, and the needs of the poor for shelter, for heat, for food are daily omnipresent. In part because in those times when the needs of the poor become the greatest, that is, in those times when the economy shrinks, when there is less prosperity in the land, all of a sudden the wealthy of the land begin to fear for their own level of standard of living and become less and less willing to give. And I find it particularly hypocritical of an administration headed by a man who, when his own IRS statement was publicized, showed himself to be most uncharitable. Less than 0.1% of the income of our president was given to charity. Here is a man who counsels that the private sector can make up for the failings of the public sector. Here is the leader giving no leadership at all. And interestingly, his few gifts, and they are in the hundreds of dollars and not in the thousands of dollars, were given to those institutions which have normally been supported by the gifts of the private sector, the hospitals, the universities, the museums, the counseling services, all those services which are other than the basic welfare needs, which have, at least since the days of the New Deal, been seen to be the responsibility of the state. And when he has been pressed, not on this private charge, but on this whole public face which his administration has given to the question of the needs of the poor, he's been heard to say, well, if the food stamps are cut back, the food companies will make up for it by donations. Or if only every church in the land would adopt 10 poor families, poverty would be eradicated and eliminated because everyone would be taken care of. There is no evidence that the president's church has been encouraged by him to take up this responsibility, or that he has said, I will personally pay for one of those 10 families. Now, there's no doubt that in the last several decades, the private sector has increased its level of giving. We've only to look at the level of funds raised by our United Torch. We've only to look at the contributions which are increasingly coming from business. But as I indicated earlier, most of these contributions are already focused, pointed towards institutions which cannot survive without them and which are important for our community's life. And business cannot, and the private sector simply cannot, at times like this particularly, make up for the billions upon billions upon billions of dollars of cutback and aid to the poor, aid to the injured, aid to the handicapped, aid to the elderly, which our administration has already set into the budget or intends to set into the budget in the next year or two. A man named John Barra, who is the chief executive officer of a company called Borg Warner and who is one of the spokesmen of the Businessmen's Council, a group of senior businessmen who have taken a leadership role in increasing the contributions of corporations to various institutions in need, has said it straight out. There is simply no way that business can replace a small fraction of what has been cut away by the government from the welfare support areas. Now, when you look at our own Jewish past, you recognize that justice, our special outlook on life, and experience, our recognition that even among a community conditioned to train to be charitable, there were always large numbers of people who wouldn't accept their burden unless it was, in fact, a taxed form of giving. When you look back on the way in which the Jewish community through the ages has supported the large array of social service institutions which it made available, social services which it made available to its members, you recognize that we turn to the government, to our own government, to do so. In Central Europe, every community was organized as a kihila. And each one of these kihilot had a council. And the council was responsible for making up the difference between what private contribution would give to the committee to ransom captives, to provide dowry for the indigent, for the daughters of the indigent, to provide hospitalization for those who were sick and who couldn't pay for it, to provide burial for the dead, for the paupers, and so on. The community simply went down the list of those who were members of the community, the households, there weren't a great number ever, and they assessed the fair share, the wealth of each member, and each member was given a percentage of the obligation which the community would, during the year, have to meet. And since the community never knew fully what those obligations were, you were told, if you were a wealthy man, that 20% of whatever was needed by the community would be your portion. And whenever the community council, the council of the Kihila, said, now we need the sums, 20% of the sum needed was your pledge, your tax, your responsibility. But that's not the way this government clearly chooses to go about it. Public welfare legislation is an attempt to transfer wealth from the overprivileged to the less privileged. It's a deliberate policy by the government to see to it that privilege and opportunity are shared as broadly by the society as can be done within the limits of equity and freedom and other assumptions of the political order. What is tragic about our present policy is that this administration has reversed, really, the whole program has been in place since the 1930s. And that its policy seems to be not the transfer of the natural patrimony from the overprivileged to the underprivileged, but the transfer of the little that the underprivileged have to the overprivileged. Instead, we seem to be determined to use the budget, to use taxation, to undo the achievements of the last 50 years. And these achievements must not be underestimated. In 1947, 33% of our society lived on or below what was then the poverty line. By the early 1970s, we had reduced that number to 11%. A great achievement. And if you wonder why the society was able to accept the shocks of the integration decisions the war in Vietnam, and all that that meant, these traumas, these social traumas, without totally tearing itself apart. It was because more Americans were living with some degree of decency, if not of comfort, in the 50s and 60s and early 70s than had been living having the America of the haves up to that period of time. But in recent years, the number who fall below the poverty line has slowly been increasing. And it's interesting, somewhat more than ironic, that the very time when the proof of the value of public welfare legislation, the welfare state, is daily shown to us, this administration seems determined to reverse progress and to undo as much as it can the social legislation on which the welfare programs of our nation are based. Cast your mind back to what you know of the Great Depression. Then, too, millions of Americans were out of work. But almost immediately after an American fell out of work in 1932 and 1933, he lost all income. Farms were repossessed, mortgages were foreclosed, soup kitchens were open in every major city, and there were long lines for food. People had nothing to fall back on. Now, 11.5 million Americans are out of work, 10.4% of the workforce. And there are hunger centers, places where the poor can go and get free food in Cleveland and in all of our major cities. But these hunger centers are today not feeding tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. They're feeding a few hundred. And the gas has not been shut off in most homes. People can still pay in some way their bills. And there is food for the table. There are food stamps. Unemployment compensation, unemployment insurance, the food stamp program, the aid to dependent children of the unemployed, Medicare, Medicaid, all of these major pieces of social welfare legislation which were put in place over the last 20 or 30 years have cushioned the shock of this economic turndown. They've allowed our society to remain a society of decency. What irony that the very moment when Americans ought to be giving thanks with every breath that these pieces of legislation are in place, and that the class divisions in the society are not widening, and that the hatreds and prejudices of society are not boiling up any more than they are, we have an administration in Washington determined to reverse the clock, to return to the 1920s, to undo as much as can be undone of this whole welfare program. You know, this present administration went into office determined to cut the size of the federal budget. It was concerned with the federal deficit, the amount of money future generations would have to pay for the services, the uses to which we have put government monies in our own day. And most Americans agreed that there was good reason to cut the federal budget, that the concern about the future was a valid one. But what happened? The first major policy decision of this administration was reflected in its budget decisions. There are four major areas in which a budget must be funded. One is the area of the maintenance and the payment of past indebtedness. One is in defense spending. One is in the area of promised services to the society for which you've already paid a certain amount of taxes and benefits, old age pensions, railroad pensions, Social Security, and the like, things which are not basically tied to need. And finally, a whole area of non-defense spending into which most of the welfare legislation, under which most of the welfare legislation comes. Now, this administration could do very little about cutting back the size of the service of the past indebtedness. It could have done a great deal in the area of the defense budget, but instead of carefully scrutinizing the defense budget, if those who report on the early days of this administration report correctly, all that Mr. Reagan and Mr. Weinberger did was to go into the Defense Department and to take the entire wish list of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, all that any of these men could dream of as games and tools and useful instruments of war, and sanctify that entire wish list as necessary to the national security, and demand of the Congress in the fiscal budget of 1983 an 18.5% increase in the defense budget, 10.5% above the inflation rate, an increase so large that many experts in the field questioned openly whether that much money could in fact be spent during that fiscal year. Not only did they question whether this particular weapon system or that particular weapon system was necessary, but questions were raised whether or not this vast sum of money could in fact be spent. But this administration did not judge between one instrumentation system and another. It did not review the wish list of the Defense Department. It sanctified it, increasing markedly the budget, increasing worse off the amount of the percentage of the budget which goes to this kind of non-human use. In the fiscal 1983 budget, 25.8% of the total budget is designated as for military purposes. In the five-year projection, for the fiscal year of 1987, if the Reagan budgets continue to go through, 38% of the federal budget will be used for military and defense purposes. Well, if you maintain your debt service and you markedly increase your defense spendings, where are you going to cut? There were only two areas: the area of Social Security, the area of old age pensions, military pensions, these entitlements, or in the so-called non-defense area. Unwilling in the early years of their administration to cut into the services which support the middle class, the administration is determined to cut and cut deeply into the area of public welfare. Billions of dollars were cut from the food stamp program, from the aid to dependent children of the unemployed, from legal services for the poor, from all of these programs which support the indigent of our nation. And one report says it all. It's from the Office of the Congressional Budget, analyzing the budget for fiscal 83 and the tax submissions of the present administration for that year. 40%, the total savings from benefit reductions during fiscal year 83, come from benefits received by one category in the society, those who are below the poverty line. And almost 70% of the savings reflected in these budgets are reductions in benefits from those who have incomes of $20,000 or less. Let me put it in another perspective. For fiscal year 1983, given the tax reductions which were already enacted and the one which is proposed, given the budget as submitted to the Congress, if all these things are in place, those who earn less than $10,000 a year will in effect be losing in benefits or in taxes $270 under the new program. Those with incomes of over $80,000 a year will find a net gain in their income of $15,130. We are taking from the poor to give to the rich. The argument is that we should do so in order to increase investment capacity. Now, obviously, there is desire, there is a need to increase investment in the reindustrialization of America. But must the poor of our nation be the cannon fodder in the war which this administration is waging in order to return our country to some degree of prosperity? Surely there are other ways. I could think of some. Billions and billions of dollars can be cut from the defense budget, which is notorious for its waste, where the whistleblowers over the years have been pilloried and scant and thrown out of government, and where the sweetheart contracts between the defense military-industrial complex and the Defense Department are notorious. Billions of dollars could be cut. But we prefer to cut from the food, the shelter, the clothing, the support which we offer to the poor. Plato said 2,000 years ago, wealth is the parent of luxury and indolence. Poverty is the parent of meanness and viciousness, and both are the parents of discontent. It worries me a great deal, not only because it is immoral for an administration to be operating in the way this administration has been operating, not only because it is unjust in an absolute sense, but because it strikes at the ability of the society to remain an open, free, and stable society, for the government to be taking from those who are least able to enhance the wealth of those who are already well off. Surely there are many other ways to accomplish desired ends. For if we fail to do so, if we continue to demand of the poor sacrifice in order to add surplus to the wealthy, if we continue to enact tax legislation which includes a dazzling set of benefits for the well-to-do, tax loopholes, increase in estate tax deductions, increased advantages for capital investment, capital profits, various kinds of advantages to those who are depreciating new industrial plants which they own. If we continue to favor the wealthy at the expense of the poor, sometime in the not too distant future, the poor will become the many, and the poor will shake off their lethargy. And it won't simply be that the wealthy are concerned to protect their possessions from erratic and haphazard crime is the reverse of erratic and haphazard generosity, but that this country will fall into that kind of ideological class conflict which characterizes most other countries of the world, of the free world, conflict which can only lead to some kind of arbitrary authority established of the left or of the right, which will undo the freedoms which we so cherish. If we believe in freedom, then we must exert ourselves to make upward mobility possible to all in the land. No other country on the face of this earth has been as prosperous, and none has come as far towards giving the other part of the society what came to be called the other America opportunity. In the early part of the 70s, only 11% of our society were still in the other America. But now the number is growing, and the policies of this present administration determine the number who fall below the poverty line will grow and grow again, the numbers will increase, and that it will become increasingly difficult for those who are below that line to move above it, because all the support systems are being taken away from them one by one. Some months ago, the president was watching television. I wish he would go out in the streets and meet some people who are not aging white American millionaires. But in any case, he was watching television, and he isn't a bad man. And this particular commentator was discussing the fate of an elderly couple. The man had worked all of his life. All that they had was a little home. There had been a new tax assessment, a heavy tax assessment. The man had lacked the money to pay it. And now the government was foreclosing on his home. And the president was disturbed. And he picked up the phone, And he called the radio commentator, and he asked how the government could help this particular man whose fate was described. And the commentators told him that this case had been brought to him by the agency which provides free legal services to the poor, an agency which the president had just determined to eliminate from the American scene. So far, we've not had that massive evidence of poverty which existed in the Great Depression because of the existence of the massive public welfare legislation of the last 40 years. And so we read about the neediest, the cases that come from, occasionally we read about them in our newspapers. Occasionally Bill Moyers will do a program on television highlighting one or two or three or four and showing through these incidents, through these families or people, the larger problem. The very time when the welfare state is working, for reasons which utterly escape me, our government is working to undo that welfare program. It can't cost that much to maintain a high level of service to the poor, to see that they can have heat during the winter, to see that they can have food for their table, to see that they dare to go to a doctor for their illnesses or to the emergency room of a hospital for first aid, to see that they can take care of their teeth before they rot in their mouths, to see that they can provide some kind of training, so get some kind of help for a disturbed child. Surely this prosperous country can find the way to fight the fight of inflation, to fight the fight for reindustrialization, and yet provide a large measure of service to the poor. Now, none of us would argue that the public welfare legislation of the last 50 years is perfect. All of us know that there have been abuses. But I would suggest to you that if one added up the abuses of those who are wealthy, abuses of privilege, abuses of station, white-collar crime, against the poor folk who occasionally will misuse their food stamps, or who occasionally double file for some kind of welfare aid, the dollars involved are not commensurate, and the crime involved is not commensurate. People are not saints, wealthy or poor. Any program will be abused, any program will be misused. Yes, if what I am saying, if you agree with it, it will cost you and it will cost me more. Someone will have to pay the bill. Some of us are going to have to recognize that some of the so-called entitlement programs, which are in existence, ought not to be funded the way they are. Need ought to be a greater factor in Social Security than it is. The middle class and the wealthy are going to have to tighten their belts. We can't ask only the poor to make the sacrifices for us. A bit of Jewish history which we don't like to remember, and I close with it. Why was it that so many young Jews of Eastern Europe in the early part of this century joined the most radical social forces of the time? It's understandable that poor non-Jews would not only join with their class in demanding some kind of opportunity in the Tsarist state or against the Prussian military lords. It's understandable that Christians would have only contempt for the way in which the church had aligned itself with the privileged and the powerful, and to try to divert people's attentions from the concerns of this world to the promises of the next. Marx's claim that the church was the opiate of the masses had a great deal of truth to it. But why did Jews buy this particular set of ideas? Jews were poor. Most Jews were. The synagogue was certainly not allied with the powerful, with the warlords, with the czar, with the rich. The answer is that in all too many communities in Eastern Europe, these town councils had been taken over by the Reaganites of the day. And when taxes were apportioned, the wealthiest who controlled the council, because they claimed they gave the most money, jiggered the tax rolls to see to it that less and less was taken from them, which meant more and more were taken from those who had less. What I'm saying is that greed is not limited to those who have not. The eye is never satisfied with seeing. What I'm saying is that this budget and this tax system of this administration is a result of the greed of the wealthy and must be seen as such. And we have to separate what this administration is doing from in the area of cutting back the services to the poor from all these other economic problems which face us, the need to revitalize the economy. We're going to have to find a way, however costly it may be, to take care of the poor and to revitalize the economy, not to revitalize the economy at the expense of the poor. That's the present policy. It's immoral and unjust and must be seen as such. Amen.